Coming up is the news.
Senior Iranian commander says the Islamic Republic considers any geopolitical change in the region a red line and a threat to its security. Former top diplomat Fumio Kishida is elected as Japan's new prime minister as the world's third largest economy grapples with pandemic-related economic challenges. Some headlines. British demonstrators rally in the northwestern city of Manchester to protest against the ruling Conservative Party's annual conference. Greetings, everyone, and welcome. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has warned that the country considers any political or geopolitical change that is in the region a red line and a threat to its security. The commander of the IRGC's ground forces said the issue of border security is of great importance for Iran. Brigadier General Mohammad Pakpur said it's key strategy for Iran that any changes to the borders of its neighbors are prevented. Pakpur noted that Iran will not tolerate the use of other countries' soils as a base for the presence and operations of Israel. His comments follow the Iranian army's drills in the country's northwestern areas, which officials said sent a warning to Israel and terrorists. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the presence of foreign forces in the region is a source of discord and damage. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has called on regional countries to provide their own security and prevent foreign interference in this regard. The leader made the comments in a ceremony held for graduates of military academies in Tehran. More in this report.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has warned countries against the consequences of relying on foreign powers to guarantee their security. The leader was addressing a virtual ceremony held for graduates of military academies in the capital, Tehran. Ayatollah Khamenei added that the presence of foreign forces in the region is a source of discord and damage. He said the armed forces of the regional countries can ensure the security of the region and that they should prevent foreign interference in this regard. The leader also spoke about the US military presence in Afghanistan and its chaotic withdrawal from the country. A row between France and the US over a security pact in the Asia-Pacific was also among issues mentioned by Ayatollah Khamenei. Last month, the US and UK announced a deal to provide Australia with technology and means to build nuclear-powered submarines. As a result of the trilateral cooperation, a similar Franco-Australian deal worth $40 billion was scrapped. French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian reacted with fury, calling the agreement a stab in the back. President Emmanuel Macron also urged Europeans to come out of what he called their naivety on the world stage and assert their independence from the United States. Iran's leader said such a spat shows that even European countries, which are not opposed to Washington, feel that there's a deficiency in achieving lasting security because of reliance on the US. America's allies are already looking on with concern at Washington's approach toward France and Afghanistan. The approach is seen as a warning to US allies in East Asia and West Asia and raises the need for them to have plans to cut dependence on the US and explore ways to ensure their own security.
The Taliban say they have destroyed a cell belonging to the Daesh terror group in the capital, Kabul, hours after a suspected attack by the terrorists killed five people there. Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid said the terrorists carried out the operation north of Kabul late on Sunday. He said all the attackers were killed as a result. Witnesses said they heard blasts and gunfire at the time of the raid. The operation took place after a deadly assault targeted the prayer ceremony at a mosque. Those killed included both civilians as well as Taliban members. Japan's parliament has voted to approve Fumio Kishida as the country's new prime minister. The new leader is expected to announce his cabinet later on today. His election came after former Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga refused to stand for the ruling party's leadership after just 1 year in office. Local media reports say Kishida plans to dissolve parliament next week and call for an election on October or for October the 31st. He faces a raft of challenges, including the pandemic-related problems of the world's third largest economy. Well, about an hour earlier, political commentator Professor Seijiro Takeshita told me Japan's new Prime Minister, Fumio Kishida, will most likely not make major changes to the country's policies compared to his predecessor.
Right now, what we're seeing is Mr. Kishida being the person who's a very good balancer. He's very good at balancing things, particularly within the LDP. So we can see that things will go pretty smoothly, but we will not, unfortunately, see a drastic, you know, transitional changes as his arch rival, Mr. Kono, would have done. Obviously, he wants to sustain the current relationship that these people have built and trying to cope with this aggression that we're facing from China, the hegemony of war between the United States and China. And Japan is obviously being swallowed in. And you were talking about North Korea, but the biggest person who has the strongest card against North Korea are not other nations like the United States or Japan. It is China, who has over 85% of trade with North Korea. So obviously, you know, if we have to make you know, a strong stance against these aggressors, obviously Japan has to basically clarify its position at a much clearer point.
Thousands of demonstrators have gathered in the UK's northwestern city of Manchester to protest against the ruling Conservative Party's annual conference there. The protesters, who described party leader Prime Minister Boris Johnson as a liar, have called on the party, held under heavy police presence, to leave the city at once. Said Pureza has sent us this report.
See a ring of steel and a little army of police, think the British Conservative Party, here in Manchester for their annual conference, with the party leader pitching his Building Back Better mantra yet again. Crashing the party, thousands of protesters from far and wide to tell the Prime Minister he and his clique are not welcome. There's an array of groups and people who have gathered here today to demonstrate against the Conservative government, pretty much everything it stands for, from its domestic policy to foreign policy, from its pandemic response and its position on migrants to its participation in foreign wars and its support for foreign occupation. And they say examples of the government's failures aren't too difficult to find.
There's a gigantic economic catastrophe threatening the lives of ordinary people. There's a gigantic climate catastrophe threatening the whole planet. There is every reason why we can't trust a government of the rich, for the rich, to deal with these problems.
Another reason that's brought these demonstrators here, the controversial policing bill that gives UK police sweeping powers.
They don't need more powers. They need to be engaging with people in a protective way, not in a way where it's oppressive.
As a result of what critics call conservative government inaction, the UK has experienced one of the highest COVID death tolls in the world, massive economic downturn, a humiliating retreat from Afghanistan, hiking taxes, fuel disruptions, and a rise in Islamophobia and xenophobia in recent years.
I want to make it really clear to the Tories that they're not welcome in this city, that actually their position on fueling racism, targeting refugees, is absolutely disgusting, and therefore we want to make sure that they know just how angry we are.
A decade of Conservative rule in the UK has led to a groundswell of public dissatisfaction, which experts say will manifest itself in the 2024 general election. Saeed Pureza, Manchester.
A UK police officer has been charged with rape only days after another officer was convicted of a similar assault as well as murder. London Metropolitan Police said David Carrick was arrested Saturday and suspended the same day. The arrest comes as the government and the police are trying to deal with the fallout from the conviction of another officer last week. 48-year-old Wayne Cousins was jailed Thursday for the rest of his life after falsely arresting a woman on the pretense she had broken coronavirus restrictions, then raping and killing her. Social media has been flooded with posts from women relating their own experiences of harassment and assault and calling for stricter political action to protect women. And now, a massive document leak has exposed hidden offshore assets worth millions of dollars, allegedly tied to over a dozen heads of state. The so-called Pandora Papers investigation, spearheaded by some 600 journalists, is based on nearly 12 million documents leaked from 14 financial services companies. Documents highlight Jordanian King Abdullah II's alleged property empire and corruption of Azerbaijani President Ilham Aliyev and his inner circle. The papers have also implicated the Czech Prime Minister, Kenyan President, Pakistan's cabinet members, Ukrainian President, and former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, among other high-profile figures. Documents were reviewed by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Economic analyst David Barkin says the elites in almost all countries try their best at it to evade tax.
I would argue, and I would urge your audience to think about the fact that although the names that you have mentioned are very, very high profile people, the scope and the depth of these revelations suggest that in almost all of our countries around the world, it's really tragic. In almost all of our countries around the world, the rich people, the elites, are going out of their way to not pay taxes, to not contribute to the development, to a balanced provision of public services and economic development for their countries. In the United States, you have a very, very small group of very corrupt legislatures, a senator, two senators, and a number of representatives in the United States Congress who are on the basis of very, very substantial contributions from international corporations preventing the enactment of legislation that would provide for the public services that are so necessary.
In the U.S., a large oil spill off the Southern California coast has devastated some of the local wildlife and left birds and fish dead. Authorities said the incident happened due to a pipeline breach about 8 kilometers off the coast of Huntington Beach. Initial reports show that an estimated 3,000 barrels have spread into the Pacific Ocean. The mayor of Huntington Beach called the spill an environmental catastrophe. Offshore drilling was restricted in the state after a devastating 1969 oil spill off the coast of Santa Barbara that dumped 80,000 barrels into the ocean. Our man in Washington, D.C., Colin Campbell, says the oil spill off Southern California will have devastating impacts on wildlife.
Of course, this was an oil slick that was about 21 square kilometers wide, and it's still reported that there is some oil leaking about 5 miles just off the coast. So this is something that is still ongoing. And, you know, the real environmental impact here is that it's influencing about 90 species of birds and fish. And that's just the initial count of how it's affecting the wildlife, as oil globules have come up ashore on the beach, affecting not just wildlife, but beachgoers who were looking to spend vacation time there. There are also some other events that were canceled because of this oil spill as they try to clean it up. Now, this happened off of a platform called Ellie, which is about, 9 kilometers off of the coastline there. And this is a serious problem because this is a state that is very sensitive to environmental catastrophes and has banned drilling at some points as well as other times. And because this has happened, this is going to be something that is going to be addressed again. There are going to be some people who are going to be very upset, especially those who are environmentally conscious, those who are environmental advocates.
Back to one of our earlier stories, the Taliban say they have destroyed a cell belonging to the Daesh terror group In the capital, Kabul, hours after a suspected attack by the terrorists killed 5 people there. Perhaps the details on that story from our man, Amin Alami, who's standing by for us, joining us via Skype at the Afghan capital, Kabul. Amin, over to you, please.
Well, this incident happened in Khairkhana area of capital Kabul. According to Taliban sources, a group of armed Daesh terrorists had launched an attack on a checkpost of Taliban in this part of capital Kabul that is also considered as the entrance gate of Kabul. According to Taliban sources here, after a few hours of exchanging of fire between the Taliban fighters and the group of Daesh terrorists there in Khairkhana area, the Taliban could successfully eliminate all the attackers of who were related to Daesh terrorist group and have successfully destroyed the hideout of this, these members of Daesh in northern part of the Afghan capital, Kabul. But this incident happened just a few hours after a huge bomb blast that rocked central part of capital Kabul. The incident happened just in front of the entrance gate of a mosque where a ceremony was underway for the passing of the mother of the spokesperson of the Taliban, Zabihullah Mujahid. Just a few minutes after that huge bomb blast, Taliban spokesman confirmed that the target of that attack has been the civilians. As a result, the spokesperson of the Interior Ministry, Khari Saeed Khusti, later confirmed that at least 3 individuals, all of them civilians, have been killed and 4 others have sustained injuries. But eyewitnesses and some other sources here in Kabul confirmed that at least 10 individuals were killed, including Taliban, and 30 others, most of them civilians, were injured as a result of yesterday's deadly bomb blast here in Kabul. Despite the Daesh terrorist group did not claim responsibility for that bomb blast, but the Taliban has repeatedly blamed this terrorist group in Afghanistan for launching such attacks. According to the Taliban, now there is no war and insecurity or clash in Afghanistan, excluding some mountainous part of Panjshir province.
Okay, many, many thanks. That's our man Amin Alami in Kabul with that update. You have a good day. And, well, it's time for me to say goodbye to you. Until next time, take care, all.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. At the center of AUKUS are technologies like artificial intelligence, quantum and cyber technologies. The United States, Britain and Australia want to use these technologies to build a new kind of footprint in the Indo-Pacific. This makes AUKUS Pact a new technology-based geopolitical alliance, the first of its kind anywhere. And AUKUS has global implications. We now present you an article written by Abhishek Prakash, an authority on geopolitics of technology. The piece is titled What AUKUS Means for the World. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. During the Trump administration, a major development took place that went under the radar. Only months after taking office, former U.S. President Donald Trump and his officials started referring to the Asia-Pacific as the Indo-Pacific. This was not by accident. It was a highly strategic and calculated move, one that would kickstart new thinking in Washington. By using the phrase Indo-Pacific, the United States was simultaneously pointing to India's rise and placing new importance on a region that is rapidly becoming the world's new center of gravity. This phrase became even more official when the U.S. military renamed its Pacific Command to U.S. Indo-Pacific Command. Jump to 15th of September 2021, and the weight the U.S. is placing on the Indo-Pacific is visible to the world. When President Joe Biden, flanked by the leaders of Britain and Australia, announced AUKUS, a new defense alliance, something else became clear. The new U.S. geopolitical strategy for the next 50 years. That is, Western Europe and West Asia are no longer the priorities. Now Washington is placing all of its attention on and marshalling all of its resources towards dominating the Indo-Pacific. And to achieve this, the United States is turning to technology. At the center of the AUKUS pact are technologies like artificial intelligence, quantum and cyber technologies. The United States, Britain and Australia want to use these technologies to build a new kind of footprint in the Indo-Pacific. This makes AUKUS a new technology-based geopolitical alliance, the first of its kind anywhere in the world. And the AUKUS pact has global implications. But first, attention must be placed on how AUKUS is splitting the West. Already, France has accused the United States of stabbing it in the back. A $40 billion deal for Australia to acquire French submarines is now scrapped. The deal was referred to as the deal of the century. Through AUKUS, Australia will get nuclear-powered submarines from the United States and Britain. Meanwhile, the Canadian media are already questioning why Ottawa was excluded from the pact. Three Canadian government officials have said Canada was not even invited to the talks for AUKUS. And New Zealand has drawn a red line, saying Australian nuclear submarines will not be allowed in its territorial waters. Also expect reactions from Germany, the European Union, and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization NATO, all of which may feel the United States is no longer prioritizing European defense. However, regardless of how the West reacts, AUKUS is going ahead. A new technology-based beachhead is being built in the Indo-Pacific that will give the United States and its allies a purported new kind of power. While the first area of work for AUKUS is providing Australia with nuclear-powered submarines, the canvas of the alliance is much, much broader. With a focus on technologies like artificial intelligence and cyber technologies, the possibilities are endless. Could AUKUS establish a new artificial intelligence-based cybersecurity shield? Or will AUKUS establish a new underwater surveillance system in the Indian Ocean using robots similar to what Russia is building? Equally important is what the new US-led geopolitical groups may morph into. Alongside AUKUS, there is the Quad, made up of the United States, India, Japan, and Australia. And US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said the Quad is far more than just a defense group. This leads to the possibility that the Quad might morph into the next G7, and AUKUS could morph into a new Asian NATO, or the next iteration of the Five Eyes intelligence sharing group. The creation of AUKUS is also a sign that globalization in its current form is ending. In the past, the US and the West created groups that involved everyone, such as the United Nations and the World Trade Organization, WTO. Now globalization is becoming vertical. With technology, the world is starting to divide and fracture. Governments are using technology to establish new walls and new barriers between themselves and the rest of the world. In the vertical world, the new groups only involve like-minded countries, not everyone. This creates a new limit for businesses. Some businesses originating from certain countries may be excluded from participating in the AUKUS Pact or Quad initiatives and projects. Last, as AUKUS takes its first step, it will not only remain in three-nation group. If the unstated goal is to take on China, the alliance has many options. AUKUS could invite Taiwan to the group, creating a new challenge for Beijing. Or AUKUS could invite Indonesia to join, a nation whose future power is largely ignored. By 2050, Indonesia will be the fourth largest economy in the world. Another way to use AUKUS is to interrupt China's Belt and Road Initiative, the BRI, especially the digital BRI, by involving Southeast Asian nations or strategically selecting nations in Central Asia and Eastern Europe. The creation of AUKUS comes at a time when the world is in a period of massive transformation, and it comes as every nation is trying to become a technology power. This new technology-based alliance fundamentally changes global politics. Now, groups like the Group of Seven, the G7, or NATO carry less weight. And traditional US allies like Canada, France, and Germany are becoming outsiders looking in. With technology, AUKUS has the power to supposedly overcome challenges that have plagued other organizations. Whether it be ideology or territory, technology can transcend these differences and barriers. But more than anything else, AUKUS signals that a new race has begun, underpinned by technology. Except, if before this race was only between the United States and China, now it involves many more nations. With technology, the world is rapidly being divided into new tribes. The question is, can these tribes coexist with one another? And if not, what happens next? Prepare for a bumpy ride.
Spotlight.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has urged countries not to rely on foreign powers for their security and not to allow them to interfere in their internal affairs. Ayatollah Khamenei argues that the presence of foreign militaries in this region, including that of the U.S., is a source of destruction and warmongering. He believes that the armed forces of regional countries are able to ensure their own security.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has warned countries against the consequences of relying on foreign powers to guarantee their security. The leader was addressing a virtual ceremony held for graduates of military academies in the capital, Tehran. Ayatollah Khamenei added that the presence of foreign forces in the region is a source of discord and damage. He said the armed forces of the regional countries can ensure the security of the region and that they should prevent foreign interference in this regard. The leader also spoke about the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan and its chaotic withdrawal from the country. A row between France and the U.S. over a security pact in the Asia-Pacific was also among issues mentioned by Ayatollah Khamenei. Last month, the U.S. and U.K. announced a deal to provide Australia with technology and means to build nuclear-powered submarines. As a result of the trilateral cooperation, a similar Franco-Australian deal worth $40 billion was scrapped. French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian reacted with fury, calling the agreement a stab in the back. President Emmanuel Macron also urged Europeans to come out of what he called their naivety on the world stage and assert their independence from the United States. Iran's leader said such a spat shows that even European countries, which are not opposed to Washington, feel that there's a deficiency in achieving lasting security because of reliance on the U.S. America's allies are already looking on with concern at Washington's approach toward France and Afghanistan. The approach is seen as a warning to U.S. allies in East Asia and West Asia and raises the need for them to have plans to cut dependence on the U.S. and explore ways to ensure their own security.
Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Allow me to introduce our guests in this edition. We have Syed Mohammad Mirandi, University Professor and Political Analyst in Tehran. Elijah Magner, Journalist and Political Analyst, is also joining us out of Brussels. Welcome to the show, both gentlemen. Let me start with Professor Mirandi. Which foreign military intervention has been able to secure this region, if you can recall any? Isn't that, therefore, a better idea for countries in West Asia to join hands and try to provide regional security in the absence of foreign powers that have somehow have vested interests?
Absolutely. We've seen the U.S. occupation of Libya. It destroyed the country. The Turkish and American occupation of parts of Syria has only led to death and destruction and devastation. Their support for extremists, ISIS and Al-Qaeda and others have even worsened the situation. The U.S. invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, of course, is well known to everyone, and the Saudi destruction of Yemen. And we really have to look at the Israeli regime, though. I think that a lot of what we see in this region would not be happening if it were not for the Israeli regime's existence. If the apartheid regime was not there and it didn't have Western backing, we would not see many of these wars. The Americans are trying to, under different circumstances, manipulate the whole region and thus leading to its destruction. The war to the northwest of Iran, when Armenia invaded Azerbaijanian territory, internationally recognized territory, Iran supported Azerbaijan. In fact, Iran, even under General Haqiqat Pour, trained the resistance in Azerbaijan for them to be able to keep their land. But ironically, the Turkish government put pressure on the Azeri president, and the Iranians were sent home, and the resistance was ended, and the occupation lasted decades. But back then, Iran was opposed to the Armenian attack on Azerbaijan, just as today it will not accept any Turkish attack, Erdogan attacking Armenia either. So the problem is that these regimes, these governments, the Americans, the Turk, the Turkish government, the Saudi regime, among others, they have, and of course the Israeli regime, they have just launched war after war after war. Saddam Hussein launched his war against Iran with Western backing, and they gave him chemical weapons. And then with Afghanistan, when the Americans created and the Saudis created the extremists to fight the Soviet Union. So they've just been manipulating this region and leading it to utter destruction.
Right. Now, Elijah, Iran has time and again stressed the fact that security cannot be purchased. Do you share the same view?
Absolutely. It is the concern of the people of the region in West Asia and Central Asia to look after their own security, but that can happen only with the talk and the meeting and agreement between the country of the region without a foreign intervention. And it is very possible to do so. We've seen the Iranians talking to the Saudis in Baghdad. We've seen Iranian talking to the Egyptians and the Jordanians. So it's very possible for countries in West Asia and in Central Asia to sit around the table and sort out their differences. The problem always comes up whenever the Americans move in and wants to impose their will and dictate their own policy and their conditions. And this is what's happening today, for example, in Yemen, where the Americans are preventing the Saudi from reaching ceasefire with Ansarullah and lifting all the siege. So whenever the Americans interfere, there is a problem. However, we've seen the performance of the Americans in Afghanistan and how the American forces failed to achieve anything after 20 years. We also have seen the American performance in Iraq. And in 2003, they managed to occupy the country. But then they left, and now the Iraqi resistance is kicking them out. So the people of the region really have enough of foreign intervention. And here, precisely, is the American intervention. But it's not only related to the countries of the region. We see also Europe is trying to create something in separate from the Americans, hegemony and control over the European continent. And that's not going to happen very soon, but what is good is we start hearing voices from France and from Germany and from the European community saying that it is time to detach ourselves a little bit from the Americans. But the Americans are not going to allow that so easily.
Okay. Now, Mohammed, what factors make some states opt for seeking military assistance instead of boosting their own military and armed forces' prowess and cater for their security?
For the most part, it is Western countries egging them on. Hmm. The war in Afghanistan was actually created by the Americans. Brzezinski, who was Carter's national security advisor, convinced Carter to support extremists in order to encourage the Soviet Union to enter Afghanistan. In other words, the Americans wanted the Soviets to enter Afghanistan, to invade Afghanistan, so that they can give them a Vietnam. Or, for example, the Americans egged on Saddam Hussein to invade Iran. They and the Europeans gave him chemical weapons, the political cover to use them, and the military intelligence to use them. And then later on, they destroyed Iraq under the pretext of chemical weapons. Or the Americans egg on Erdogan, who's been a very foolish leader. The first decade of his leadership was very good. He had made huge progress in Turkey, and the Turkish people deserved that. And then in the second decade, we've seen him enter Syria, support ISIS and Al-Qaeda. One of your colleagues was murdered on the Turkish border, Sirin Eşim, when she was reporting that Turkish intelligence was supporting ISIS, and that ISIS was using World Food Organization trucks, which belong to the UN, to bring in ISIS troops and supplies.
Right.
And then when she was threatened by Turkish intelligence, she died in an accident hours later at a time when she was worried, and she gave a live report. So the Americans push, or NATO pushes, countries like Turkey to destroy Syria, to create tension between Azerbaijan and Armenia for their own ambitions as well, of course. Erdogan's personal ambitions are also important. And then you have Yemen, where the Saudis have destroyed and decimated the country. Then Libya, which we saw despotic regimes, oil-rich regimes, and others supporting the destruction of the country alongside NATO. So a lot of it's because of NATO, and a lot of it is when NATO eggs on regional regimes to do their bidding and make promises to them. But the result is that Saudi Arabia has lost a huge amount of wealth. Turkey under Erdogan, the first decade, a huge success. The second decade, an utter failure. And we see that European countries have more and more refugees flowing in because of their own policies in Libya, in Syria, and elsewhere in this region.
Okay, now let me ask Elijah, let's look at some specific instances of foreign intervention. Let's take a look at Afghanistan, for instance, and see what the U.S.-led foreign force performance was like in that country in the past 20 years. Which of their stated goals were achieved, Elijah? Was terrorism uprooted? Did they make life easier for Afghans, or instead brought them misery and chaos?
After 20 years, during the Taliban, before the occupation of the Americans of Afghanistan, the Taliban movement managed to stop the selling and the production of drugs. And when the Americans arrive, after 20 years, the selling of drugs has increased. The infrastructure all over Afghanistan, at the exception of Kabul, was pitiful. The Al-Qaeda that the Americans came to remove declared their loyalty to the emir of the Taliban movement, and they're still in the country alongside with the Taliban. Mm-hmm. And nothing has been achieved. All the goals have not been achieved. What has been achieved is the Americans, wherever they go, they appoint responsible and people who are in charge of the state who are corrupted. And this is what has been achieved in Kabul. The Afghan leadership is highly corrupted, and this is what the Americans manage to do always wherever they go in any country they have occupied.
Now, Mohammed, who benefits from wars in other countries? I mean, the crisis of countries or those countries that sell weapons or foreign mercenaries?
Well, it's not the countries that sell weapons. It's the military-industrial complex. They grow increasingly powerful in those countries, and therefore they take more and more of their resources. We see that in the United States itself, where the middle class is being emptied out partially because of perpetual war. And the military-industrial complex is making money out of these wars. They're pushing for wars because they make money that way. And so the American people are not benefiting. In our region as well, it's the military-industrial complex of Western countries mostly that make a great deal of money because they're mostly privately owned. They're privately owned. So when, sadly, Erdogan went into Syria and began funding these terrorist organizations, many factories and companies were making money out of this. Mm-hmm. When the Saudis began their invasion of Yemen and the destruction of the Yemeni infrastructure, hundreds of billions of dollars, along with the UAE, which has been just as criminal in this endeavor, hundreds of billions of dollars of weapons were purchased from the United States, from Canada, from the United Kingdom, from France, and all these countries are just as guilty of crimes against humanity as Erdogan or as Mohammed bin Salman and the others in this region. And of course, there's always the Israeli regime. The ultimate, alongside the military-industrial complex, the ultimate, let's say, benefit goes to the apartheid regime in Palestine, because when you see Libya, which was the most wealthy country in Africa, decimated, who benefits? Mm-hmm. When you see Syria, which was a powerful country in West Asia, when it is broken, who benefits? When Lebanon is brought down by the Americans through economic siege, who benefits? Or in Yemen, or the war, the Saddam Hussein invasion of Iraq, of Iran, or Mr. Erdogan's support for extremists in the Caucasus and elsewhere. It's all of this benefits the Israeli regime, because the more instability there is in our region, the better it is for this regime to be able to sustain itself. But the fact is that the tide has turned, and the United States, NATO, and its allies in this region are losing ground. Erdogan has lost a lot of his popularity, and he's severely damaged his country's economy and credibility. Mohammed bin Salman is not completely sane, and he's driving the Saudi Arabia towards a cliff because they cannot spend forever. The Americans had to leave Afghanistan, the Americans, which are much, much stronger than Saudi Arabia. So can Saudi Arabia continue this war in Yemen forever? Definitely not. So the U.S. is shooting itself in the foot by supporting these different wars or by being involved in these wars. But because the Israeli regime benefits, because the military-industrial complex benefits, that clouds their vision, that clouds their logic and their thinking, and therefore they accept this foolishness, which ultimately will help bring down their empire in this part of the world and by extension elsewhere.
Now, Elijah, former President Donald Trump let the cat out of the bag, and regarding American military presence on Syrian soil, he clearly stated America is in Syria in his own words to keep the oil. Let's have your take on that.
President Trump declared himself the thief of the Syrian wealth, and particularly oil and gas in the northeast Syria, without feeling any shame. When we heard four-star American generals saying we are not pirates, we are professional soldiers, the American president didn't really care about what his generals are saying because he wanted to stay there. Moreover, the reason why the Americans stay in northeast Syria is to please Israel and to offer to Israel the platform to attack Syria and to attack Iraq, also to prevent the reconstruction of Syria following a decade of war, notwithstanding the fact that today the war is no longer useless, it's useless and no longer reaching any objective. All those belligerents and the countries who supported that war acknowledge that, yet we still have the Americans in the northeast of the country and the Turk occupying the northwest, and they're still there without any purpose but to damage the Syrian population. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, the Americans imposed the Caesar Act sanctions on Syria. So there is no purpose. The Americans' behavior have no meaning, and it only reached the damage to the population.
Okay. Mohammed, we have 1 minute. If you could tell me how you look at the prospect of foreign presence in the West Asia region, what's your prediction?
The United States hates the people of this region. That's why they don't care for Christians or Muslims or Shias or Sunnis or Jews. When it's Saddam Hussein, they'll help him because they want to support Israel. They'll destroy him because they think it'll help Israel. They'll destroy Syria, Lebanon, wherever. It's all for Syria. And, of course, the military-industrial complex. Even now in the Caucasus, the Americans were supportive when the Armenians were occupying Azeri towns and villages. And then when the Iranians were supporting them, the Americans and the Turkish government forced the Azeri government to expel the Iranians and end their resistance, leaving that land occupied for decades. And then now the Americans are there and encouraging the Turkish government to occupy southern Armenia. Why? Because all of this benefits the Israeli regime. Of course, the Turkish government can't do that. The Iranians won't allow it. But the point is that the Americans don't care if they're Muslims or Christians or Jews. Their manipulation of this region is to weaken the resistance, to strengthen NATO in order to strengthen Israel. And some regimes and some leaders, because of their own personal ambitions and foolishness, or because of their weakness, abide by American policies and are manipulated into pursuing those policies. But as I said, the United States is on the decline, and so are its allies, and so is Israel.
Okay, and that note, we come to the end of this edition of The Spotlight. Thank you, my guests, Said Mohammad Mirandi, University Professor and Political Analyst in Tehran, and Elijah Magner, Journalist and Political Analyst in Brussels. I've been your host, Behruz Najaf, and I'll see you next time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar. Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar. Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This program is about the life and times of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul. And in today's program, we're going to begin it by listening to a quote from the Supreme Leader, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, who's going to say a few things about this great personality.
Agar izzat, izzat nafs, dar darune layehay amiq wujood insan nufuz kard.
If self-respect permeates the deepest layers of one's being, one will not be affected by Satan. One will not be affected by human passions. One will not become a slave to lust and wrath. And Imam Khomeini was such a person.
Imam dar tool hayat, che dar hawzeh ilm o tadris.
Throughout his studying and teaching years, throughout the time he was engaged in political activities, and throughout the time he was managing the country, Imam Khomeini remained in manifestation of, quote, rely on the mighty, the merciful. The Holy Quran, chapter 26, verse 217.
برای همین بود که کارهای بزرگ که همه میگفتند نشدنی است.
It was for this reason that he managed to do what was considered impossible. All the obstacles which were considered insurmountable became surmountable after he stepped into the arena. Not only was Imam Khomeini the embodiment of honor and spiritual power, but he also revived the spirit of honor among our people. This was the great achievement that our magnanimous Imam accomplished.
روح عزت را در ملت هم زنده کرد. این کار بزرگ امام بزرگوار بود. ملت ما با احساس عزتی که از درس‌های انقلاب و امام آموخت.
Our nation rediscovered itself by relying on the sense of honor that it gained from Imam Khomeini and the revolution. Our nation discovered itself and its capabilities. And this is the reason why we have seen many of the divine promises being fulfilled in front of our eyes over the past few decades. We have seen with our own eyes the kind of things that we would only read about in history books. Over these years, we have seen the arrogant powers being defeated by the oppressed. We have seen that the seemingly impressive castles of the arrogant powers are built on air. We have seen many such things.
Once again, very powerful description of how he viewed the great Imam. And he mentions the fact that, of course, the Imam, as you mentioned in previous programs, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, first of all, I'd like to say salam to you and welcome to you to the program.
Alaykum salam rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
He mentions the fact that, of course, Imam Khomeini came to help the oppressed. He came to raise those people who were oppressed, to give them confidence to stand and make their stand against the tyrants of our time. And, of course, we're going to speak about some major events that took place at the outset of the Islamic Revolution here in Iran, because there was so much going on, there's so much to speak about, and there were so many great events which really, both in the East as well as the West, we were completely taken aback by. We were sometimes quite shocked by what was happening. But again, the Supreme Leader makes it very clear that the way he views the Imam as a pure personality who really challenged the Satan of our time. So, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, can you take us to the next level, if I can put it that way, in terms of, what the Supreme Leader had to say about this great personality?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think what we heard from the Supreme Leader, and by the way, what we heard in those few sentences was the Supreme Leader speaking at the anniversary of the death of Imam Khomeini,
right,
which
right.
is held every
that's
year.
That's very important. Yes, of
at
course.
At the shrine. Of Imam Khomeini.
So this is the context in which
right.
we heard this
And in
quote.
That in that annual event, you have the Supreme Leader coming and talking about Imam and the revolution, and it's actually one of the important events,
yes,
of the calendar in the Islamic Republic. And, you know, as he said, you know, we saw these things with our own eyes.
With our own eyes.
We witnessed these things. We experienced these things. And he said that, you know, when somebody has complete trust in Allah, then, you know, shaitan, the devil, Iblis, whatever you want to call it, that inner, you know, that self which, you know, leads you to the wrong things,
yes,
does not control you any longer.
Yes.
You are not swayed by threats. You are not deceived
by offers. Yes.
You don't let your anger and your desires, you know, get in the way of what needs,
yes,
to be done,
mm,
and the way you need to act and behave properly. So this is what the Supreme Leader talks about when he's talking about Imam. And he talked about the fact that this was the case at the time when Imam was a seminary teacher, you know. This was the case before the revolution when he was leading the revolutionary movement. And this was the case after the victory of the Islamic Revolution,
right,
and where he was the leader, the,
mm-hmm,
Supreme Leader, and the Imam of this revolution,
sure,
and the Islamic Republic.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, each stage... each of these stages has its own tricks and its own deceptions and its own
traps, yes.
And in each stage you had a man from the beginning
who's firm,
who worked on himself at a young age.
Mm.
And remember, Imam always used to tell us, he used to say, you work on yourself when you're young. You know, gain control of yourself when you're young.
Young.
Person.
Mm.
It's very difficult when you get older.
That's true.
Mm. And, you know, we even have this in Islamic,
yes,
Irfan. We,
yes,
have it in Islamic, you know, the
teachings, yes.
The teachings, the, mm, the ethics teachings that, you know, when you reach 40, things are
not
rooted.
Are rooted,
your,
yes,
behaviors become rooted in your personality.
Exactly.
Not that it's impossible, but becomes more difficult.
Becomes more difficult.
These behaviors then have, you know, established roots,
mm,
and it becomes more difficult to rip them out.
Rip them out.
And those good behaviors that you have, in the same way,
mm,
you have rooted them, they have become part of your personality. But after 40, and you know, 40 is one of those magical
years,
you know,
yeah,
we have this in many religions,
yes,
we even have it in Judaism, we have, yeah, it, you know, in different,
yes, absolutely,
in different traditions where the age of 40 is one of those. We have it in the Quran,
mm,
you know, where you reach 40, you thank God for the parents that you had, and
that's right, yes, absolutely.
You know, you yourself have become a parent,
yep,
and you realize, mm, many things. So,
mm,
Imam used to tell everyone that, you know, work on yourself when you're young. So he did this for himself. He was known before he was known as a faqih, before he was known as a legal scholar. At the time when he was younger and teaching in the Hawza, he was known as the teacher of philosophy and of ethics. And, you know, this is what he did. So when these challenges then happened in his life, he was able to
withstand them
and to respond to them in the,
yeah,
way that pleases Allah.
Exactly, which pleases Allah. That's a very, very important
point. When he was given, mm, when he was given worldly power, he,
mm,
did not abuse it.
No, he didn't.
He did not lose himself. He did not, you know, do things that would make,
well,
us ashamed.
Well, let me put it in
make
a
himself ashamed.
Exactly. Let
we've
me
talked about many times.
Yeah,
just
in a conventional sense.
We've talked many, mm, times about people going to Jamaran,
mm,
visiting his residence,
yes,
so to speak.
I've seen it,
and you know,
yes,
we say residence with a little smile.
Smile, yes.
It's quote unquote residence. It's,
mm,
a 60-meter apartment.
Apartment. It's very small.
You know, which 60 square meters,
mm,
which is where he, where Imam and his wife lived,
mm,
at the time when he was the leader of the Islamic Republic.
Well, that's what I'm saying, because I was going to say that in the conventional sense,
two rooms,
that you have these charismatic leaders, or you know, even in a positive sense, if I want to put it that way. But of course, you know, when you look at their residence, when you look at the salary they get received, the benefits and the privileges of their position,
right,
you know, Imam Khomeini had none of that, and that was the first thing that threw us when we first encountered this gentleman at the time of the, you know, this leader at the revolution, that we began to understand that here was a man who never gave a damn for palaces, for, you know, extraordinary residencies. And, you know, I mean, I've seen the place myself. I went there, and, you know, there's a plaque outside the door which says that this was rented.
Yeah, it was rental.
Rented. I mean, that's the thing. It's rented to a leader. I mean, a country that is rich in oil wealth.
Think about this for a second.
Yeah.
You are the leader of a revolution. Sure. People, you know, sacrificing themselves for you.
Exactly.
He insists on renting this place and paying it with his own money.
With his own money. And it's, you know...
Not... And he says, you know, I'm not going to take money from the state coffers.